Love and Light. This is Healthy Talk Show for Sunday, March 17th, 2019. I'm Robert.
And I'm Marissa.
Healthy Talk Show streams live on Sundays at 3 p.m. Pacific Standard Time, 2300 UTC at healthytalkshow.com/live with podcast versions available soon after over at healthytalkshow.com/subscribe. healthytalkshow.com/support if you'd like to help support the show financially using PayPal or Patreon. It's value for value. If we provide you value, please provide some back in whatever form you feel. And yes, feedback is valuable. Rate us on iTunes, email us, or call and leave us a voicemail at 509-878-3229. Subscribe to our YouTube channel, healthytalkshow.com/YouTube. Show notes for this episode with the links of everything we talk about located over at healthytalkshow.com/HTS12. Show housekeeping. We added an Amazon wish list so people can buy us stuff over at healthytalkshow.com/support. Let's take a look over here. Look at this. We got some stuff. $6-$7. Streaking Kittens, the second expansion to Exploding Kittens. We definitely need that.
Yeah,
got some beef jerky
then
on here.
We'll play it on stream.
We got everything. Yeah. Mysterium expansion. Those aren't prime eligible. We might have to remove those.
Oh.
Yep. A lot of things. If you want to buy us stuff, some Lego stuff to build on stream, NASA
Heck
shirts
yes.
that we'll wear on stream, all kinds of good stuff. Help us out. Send us stuff for free.
Oh, don't we also have the food delivery service?
Yeah, we do. That's on Twitch, though. That's specific to Twitch.
Oh, well,
I think it should be up right now. Yeah, we are going to add shot callers for the dog. Don't worry.
If anyone is watching on Twitch live, you can send us food.
Yeah, you can send us food.
Or you can always donate to the show if you find value in the show. Support us.
HealthyTalkShow.com/support.
Yeah.
PayPal would be the preferred form because they take the least amount of money, I think. Last week, what?
Oh, I was going to say, yeah, I believe so, if it's just like a gift or something.
Yeah. Last week, we had a great episode, healthytalkshow.com/HTS11, where we discussed something very, very controversial. And I feel like I let us down, because when we were talking about DST, I did not bring up something very important.
Oh, yeah.
The Sacramento Bee, Californians voted for year-round daylight savings. Could this be our last spring forward? Proposition 7, approved by 60% of voters in November and sponsored by Assemblyman Kassan Chu, Democrat San Jose, repealed the 1949 initiative that started daylight saving time in California. The proposition also known... On Thursday, Senator Marco Rubio, Republican in Florida, introduced Senate Bill 670 in the Senate, which would allow all states to switch to year-round daylight savings time if they passed the bill through state legislature. So that's pretty cool. I just want to talk about that because, yeah, we are on the way to getting rid of or keeping it standard, I guess. It's maybe. Yeah.
Well, we'll see if it happens.
Yeah, I know.
I'm not holding my breath yet, so.
I know. It's kind of sad. Daylight savings. The controversy that is daylight savings. What happened to my video here? Oh, that's not good. All right. Well, we want to get into it.
Yeah. What do we got?
All right. Senator Josh Haley questions Mr. Will DeVries, Senior Privacy Counsel for Google, on consumer privacy in the Senate Judiciary Committee. Let's play it.
I'm concerned about the implicit bargain that consumers are being asked to ratify, by which they get supposedly free services, but actually have enormous amounts of personal data extracted from them without knowing what exactly is going on. And Mr. DeVries, I'd like to begin at least with you and your company, the largest, arguably most powerful company in the world. I note in your written testimony, you say for over 20 years now, our flagship products have been free. And then you go on to say, next paragraph, that Google clearly explains how it makes money and clearly explains how your products use personal information. And my question is that really true? Are any of those statements actually true? So let's take some examples. Let's start with location tracking. Let's start with your Android phones. Do you think the average consumer would be surprised to learn that her location is recorded and sent to Google hundreds of times every day, even when she is not using her phone?
Hundreds of times?
Wow.
This is talking specifically about Android phones and location data, obviously. And we're going to listen to this Google Mr. William DeVries, Senior Privacy Counsel for Google. He's going to respond to this. He was a little outclassed, in my opinion, on this. I don't know why they didn't send somebody else, but we'll see.
Thank you, Senator. I do think we take as strong an effort as possible to try to explain these things clearly. I understand that it's complicated the way a mobile phone works.
Do you think that she would be surprised to learn that even when she's not using the phone, an Android phone, Google is receiving information about where she is? For instance, it's every 4 minutes or 14 times an hour.
They're sending data back 14 times an hour?
That was insane to me.
That's a lot of data. Why are you using all my bandwidth?
Yeah.
What do you do? You have a 2 gig limit on your phone, Marissa.
I know. Man. No wonder I always use my data.
Yeah, no wonder I always hit your cap.
340 times during a 24-hour period. That's without use of the phone. Do you think she'd be surprised to learn that?
So, Senator, I know that location information is absolutely core to making a mobile phone work the way that you want it to work. It's what makes maps work. It's what makes your phone calls be able to be routed correctly. And we have an optional...
I don't buy the phone calls being routed correctly. That doesn't make sense.
I mean, when you make a phone call, won't it just find the tower then?
Yeah.
Why does it need to know your location every 4 minutes?
Yeah.
Service that's opt-in. Exactly. Called location history, which can collect location over time if people turn that on. I think there's more that we can do to explain location more clearly, and I've heard your concerns.
Well, Google collects geolocation data even if location history is turned off, correct?
Yes, Senator, it can in order to operate other services.
Let's just get that on the record. Google collects geolocation history and information even if location history is turned off.
That's pretty important.
Ooh.
That's an important point. Even if its location history is turned off, they're still collecting data.
Do you think that an average consumer, let's say a teenager with an Android phone, would be surprised to learn that Google is tracking his location even when location services are turned off by scanning Wi-Fi networks around him throughout the day? Do you think he'd be surprised by that?
Senator.
It goes on. I have another 4 minutes if you guys want to keep here. I don't know how you feel about it, Marissa. Maybe we'll play the last one.
Yeah.
We'll see where it goes.
I know that this data is used to provide value back to the user, to make their phone work.
You're not really answering my questions. You're telling me you don't think a consumer should be surprised? You think they should anticipate that? They have location services turned off.
This is fascinating. What value are you talking about?
Well, Senator, so in order to make, say, maps work, to be able to locate you, to give you directions.
I think that was Lindsey Graham.
You go. Maps needs to know where you are.
The phone's off. Yeah.
Well, it's in order to be able to just perform basic functions to keep itself.
Location services are off.
Indeed, Senator. In order to be able to know where it is so it can route phone calls to you, so it can collect the basic information.
So the consumer cannot meaningfully opt out. I mean, he has gone and tried to turn location services off. He's not using his phone. It's still communicating and sending information to you. And you're monetizing it and using it to direct ads at him, correct?
Oh, I like that. Monetizing the information being collected, correct? Making money on it, correct?
Let's see.
We are not using that information to direct ads at him, no, sir.
Oh,
okay, sure. Good.
This is to provide value back to the user in terms of making their services operate.
Wait. You don't use the information?
He zeroes in.
What do you do with that information?
We use it to make sure that we understand.
It's not of monetary value to you?
There is some ways that location can be used for ads. So, for instance, your IP address.
Well, I thought you just said it wasn't used for ads.
Senator, there's the kind of geolocation that's sent from the cell towers, from your GPS device, that's used for purposes that are really about making the phone operate. I'm happy to explain this in more detail. I understand it's a complicated topic, and we could communicate it better.
I don't know that it is that complicated. I think when somebody turns off their user information, their location history, they expect the location tracking to be off. But it's not, in fact. They don't have a way, apparently, to turn it off. Let's take another example. Do you think that an average consumer who's using your products fully understands that Google builds a profile about her, tracks where she goes to work, tracks where her boyfriend lives, tracks where she goes to church, tracks when she goes to the doctor? Do you think that an average consumer would anticipate that?
Probably not, I'm going to say. I have the rest of you. You can watch it, healthytalkshow.com. Go there, /HTS12. Everything will be there.
It's kind of funny. They kind of spanked that Google guy.
And what the point of that is, it's weaponization of information against you to, well, I say weaponization, but it's to get you to spend money. So that is not healthy.
Yeah.
You're being targeted to spend money on things you don't need.
That's true. And we don't fully realize how that information's being used because they're tracking our patterns. And
yeah, we don't. We don't have.
Yeah, they're tracking who you interact with potentially, and somehow that could be used to manipulate you.
If there was no value in it, they wouldn't be doing it.
Yeah,
Okay, so the Roku, remember, Roku remotes, as soon as you pick up the Roku remote, it's tracking your movements just based on the remote itself. It's getting crazy. Well, I don't understand.
Plus, I thought it was interesting that he happened to mention the example of going to the doctor. So my next question is this going to be passed on to other people too? You know, potentially that you have illnesses or, I don't know. It's just, there's way too much information.
Too much.
And I don't know how it's going to be used, especially the combination. Google already knows what you're searching. Now they know where you're going.
Yeah.
I don't know.
It comes down to a lot of this, the end user license agreement, which we're all vaguely familiar with, a EULA. An end user license agreement is a legal contract between a software application author or publisher and the user of that application. The EULA, often referred to as the software license, is similar to a rental agreement. The user agrees to pay for a privilege of using the software and promises the software author or publisher to comply with all restrictions stated in the EULA. The user is asked to indicate that they accept the terms of the EULA by opening the shrink wrap on the application package, breaking the seal in the CD case, sending a card back to the software publisher, installing the application, executing a downloadable file, or simply by using the application.
So I found that pretty interesting as well, because there's no real verification that you agreed to.
Exactly.
And people, what you agreed to.
People don't read these things. I don't read these things. I write contracts professionally for a living, and I don't read the EULAs all the time because there's just too much to read.
Yeah. You brought up a suggestion, though, for the EULAs, remember?
Oh, yeah, having a test at the end of them. Well, you know, we're all about regulation and all that, so why not? You know, why not have some Or what about accessibility for EULAs? Think about that.
That's another good point.
And I mean,
you write contracts for a living, so you probably have a better idea of what they're saying. But people that aren't familiar with the technical jargon and with the legal jargon.
I have a hard time reading EULAs. And again, I write contracts for a living.
So how is
the
more common person supposed to?
Someone doesn't read contracts.
Yeah.
It's interesting. And a general rule in contracting. The one writing the contract holds the power. Just remember that when you're signing contracts.
That's probably a good rule of thumb.
It is a good rule. It's true. And in our chat room, our friend says, I always read the EULA. Yeah, right. No way. Some of those things are so long. Hey, Alana's in the chat. Hey, our friend. All right, moving on. Bloomberg. Google, Facebook set 2018 lobbying records as tech scrutiny intensifies. Alphabet Inc.'s Google unit, Google, Amazon Inc. and Facebook Inc. set company records for lobbying spending in 2018. Alphabet Inc.'s Google unit spent more than $21 million to influence Washington, beating their previous record of more than $18 million in 2017. Amazon reported spending $3.7 million in the fourth quarter, bringing its total to $14.2 million for the year, more than the record $12.8 million back in 2017. Facebook spent nearly $13 million in lobbying in 2018 and more than $11.5 million in lobbying in 2017, and the other one was 2018. Man. Yeah.
Very interesting.
Yep. And check this out. When including spending by Microsoft, $9.5 million, and Apple, $6.6 million. Interesting. The industry's big five shelled out $64.3 million to fight numerous legislative and policy battles in 2018.
Wow.
Woo! That's a lot of money influencing Washington. And we wonder why.
Yeah.
Nothing's getting done with technology.
I know, between the drug companies and now tech companies.
Yeah, they're just all lobbying these people. Hey, take some money. It's sad. Moving on. The Verge. Tinder says it no longer uses desirability score to rank people. The idea behind the ELO score was that Tinder would rank people by attractiveness. ELO scores are used to rank chess players too, but in the context of Tinder, the more people that swiped right or liked a person's profile, the higher their assigned score went up. Their card would then be served to other people with a similar score, thereby keeping the most desirable people interacting with one another. On Tinder, where the profiles are relatively limited in scope, a person's looks often fuel much of the desire to match, so people speculated that these scores kept hot people talking to one another and left undesirable people to wallow in the low ranking. Funny.
Thought that was pretty interesting.
Yeah. And then it goes on. Tinder, unlike other apps, only requires users to input their age, distance, and gender preferences. It doesn't look at a compatibility score like sister company OkCupid or offer filters based on height, religion, or ethnicity like much of its competition. Our algorithm is designed to be open, the company says. Today, we don't rely on Elo, though it is still important to consider both parties who like profiles from a match. Okay, well,
yeah.
There you go. Good old Tinder.
But then I did like that article too, the blog that where it says Powering Tinder.
Yeah, I have that.
And that one talked about what they actually use now, that it's based more on activity and who's actively swiping.
Yeah.
So hopefully to get active users connected faster. So I thought that was pretty cool.
Yeah, because there's a lot of dead profiles on Tinder.
Yeah. Or just in the internet in general. Yeah. There's a lot of dead profiles.
Tinder is so superficial, though. And yeah. People are so fake. So many matches, so little messages going back and forth. It's bad.
But what are the alternatives?
I always would say OkCupid, but they ban VPNs. They'll block you if you use a VPN.
That's true. And
so screw OkCupid.
We don't want to surf the internet unprotected.
Yeah, you can't surf the internet without a condom. You have to have a VPN.
Yeah.
I don't care. OkCupid, get over your war against VPNs. You don't need to know where I'm at. You don't need to know my IP address. Get over it. Moving on. Stanford Medicine, Apple Heart Study demonstrates ability of wearable technology to detect, how do you say that word? Atrial fibrillation. I will butcher that word every time. Stanford researchers presented preliminary findings from a virtual study that enrolled more than 400,000 participants. Researchers from the Stanford University School of Medicine today presented preliminary results of Apple Heart Study, an unprecedented virtual study with over 400,000 participants. The researchers reported that wearable technology can safely identify heart rate irregularities that subsequent testing confirmed to be atrial fibrillation. Have you said that?
Yeah, atrial fibrillation.
Atrial fibrillation. Dang it. A leading cause of stroke and hospitalization in the United States. Apple sponsored the study.
Yeah. Their numbers were pretty good, though. They said 84% of the time participants who received irregular pulse notifications were found to be in atrial fibrillation at the time of the notification. But it all goes back to how is that data being used and privacy concerns.
Yeah.
And, you know, we've been talking about that topic for a while now.
We continue to harp on that topic.
Yeah, there's still no solutions. So what happens now with this data? It's useful, but do you really want Apple collecting your heartbeat all the time?
Who controls the data?
Precisely.
Who controls the data? And what do they want to do with it? And how are they going to make money from it?
All about selling you ads.
Yes. It's apparently what life's all about, just getting ads. Huh. Daily Mail, are wireless earbuds dangerous? Tiny wireless Bluetooth headphones fit into the ear canal. 250 scientists from over 40 countries have signed a petition to the World Health Organization and the UN to warn against radio wave radiation from wireless technologies. The close proximity of AirPods to the brain and inner ear may raise cancer risks. Little research exists on Bluetooth and its health effects, but it also uses radio wave radiation. AirPods talk to one another using a magnetic field that passes through the brain. And then, funny from the article, Dr. Mushkachevitz, a University of California, Berkeley community health professor who focuses on cell phone exposure, says there isn't even research on what this could do to the brain yet, let alone regulations to limit the potential effects. But I couldn't imagine it's all that great for you, he says. More from the article. Wi-Fi 2 has been shown to pose cancer risk. The World Health Organization has developed guidelines for the level of electromagnetic frequency, EMF, that various devices are allowed to expose users to. But the authors of the petition to the UN and WHO argue research has revealed evidence that EMF may be carcinogenic at even lower levels. And brain cancers are among the forms that research links to EMF radiation. So we don't know.
Yeah. I wanted to put a few things in context, though.
Okay.
And we're about to talk about 5G.
Mm-hmm.
So 4G, just for everyone's record, is about 0.7 to 2.1 gigahertz. For the frequency, Bluetooth is 2.4 gigahertz, so a little
same as Wi-Fi.
Yeah, so Wi-Fi. And then the proposed 5G is supposed to be anywhere from 0.6 gigahertz to 6 gigahertz, and then some in the millimeter range, which would be 24 to 86 gigahertz. And then for those people that are worried about body scanners, so body scanners are 30 to 300 gigahertz. So, you know, try to put things in context. We don't really know all this pollution. So let's see what the 5G article says.
Yeah, and back to just AirPods specifically, the issue that I see with these is that people leave them in their ear all the time. They just pop them in and leave them in. That's bad. That's bad. You should not have anything in your ear for that long. Not even hearing protection. You gotta take it out.
That's true.
After a period of time. Yeah, it's a chat room. They don't like your AirPods, apparently. That's good. We're very good. Moving on. Inverse. Does 5G internet really give you cancer? Here's what we know and don't know. This is a really well put together article. I liked it. People who promote the link between cell phones and cancer often cite a large-scale study conducted by the National Toxicology Program, NTP, a division of the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services. The final version came out at the end of 2018. In the study, researchers exposed more than 7,000 rats and mice to radio frequency, RFR, radiation. Oh, that's the type emitted by cell phones over the course of multiple years, and analyzed the effects on the animals. Again, back to what you're saying. We don't know. Because it's different. NTP studied 2G and 3G technologies only. Current wireless communication networks like 4G still use 2G and 3G technologies for voice calling and texting. 4G, 4G LTE, and 5G networks were developed to support increased data needs like streaming video or instantly downloading email with attachments. These newer technologies use different methods of cell phone signal modulation than we used in the study. 5G is an emerging technology that hasn't really been defined yet, and it differs dramatically from what we studied.
Yeah, so we don't really know.
We're still following 5G, everybody.
I think there were some criticisms of the study that the rats were exposed to too much radiation, and that's not actually accurate of how much radiation you'd get.
Yeah,
but
for 2 years at a time.
But at the same time, as we continue to have these wireless earbuds, our Wi-Fi, our 5G now, all radiating us at levels that we haven't studied.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That we haven't had long-term exposure to.
Yeah, and that's the problem with the technology is it comes out too fast before we can study it. And so we never say, whoa, let's slow down.
And the press covering technology, because I listen to a lot of technology press. I love technology, obviously. They are not critical of technology that way. They just see new technology and say, that's the best. We got to do it. They don't think of the ramifications of the technology that they're implementing. They don't see that part. They're never critical. They are the... They are not critical of many things. The technology press is bad in a lot of ways.
They'll be what sets you apart. You're critical.
Yeah, we're critical here in Healthy Talk Show.
Yeah, we try to analyze everything.
Well, here's an interesting one. Science Daily, mental health issues increased significantly in young adults over the last decade. The percentage of young Americans experiencing certain types of mental health disorders has risen significantly over the past decade, with no corresponding increase in older adults, according to research published by the American Psychological Association. More U.S. adolescents and young adults in the late 2010s versus the mid-2000s experienced serious psychological distress, major depression, or suicidal thoughts, and more attempted suicide, said lead author Jean Twenge, PhD author of the book iGen, and professor of psychology at San Diego State University. These trends are weak or non-existent among adults 26 years and over, suggesting a generational shift in mood disorders instead of an overall increase across all ages.
Yeah, so I found this really interesting, one, because I've personally been following Twinge's research
for
almost about a year now. We were actually citing her research, and she's part of why we want to do
the podcast. I didn't put two and two together until what you said earlier, I had no idea what you were talking about.
Yeah.
Whatever Bruce was talking about, I don't know.
Plus, this study also kind of shows that this rise isn't just a link to an overall rise in over-medication, which we will address actually a little bit later today.
Stay tuned.
Yeah. So, very interestingly, and Twinge talks a lot about the effects of social media, especially on females, that their images, you know, they have a lot of body image issues very young because they're on the Instagram. They're seeing all these perfect bodies.
Augmented.
And then they don't feel adequate. And this is also leading to increased rates of suicide among teens, like unprecedented rates. And she definitely cites that the rise of social media. So definitely check out her work.
And keep your kids off of social media.
Yeah.
That's a popular opinion. like to have the popular ones.
Parents have to.
Parents need to parent. Sorry.
Sorry.
Sorry. Sorry, not sorry. Engadget, Family Tree DNA will let customers opt out of the FBI's genetic data access. Awesome. Genealogy company Family Tree DNA hit the headlines last month after it revealed the firm had given law enforcement agencies access to its DNA database. The FBI was allowed to comb through the information in a bid to identify crime suspects, igniting confidentiality concerns and privacy fears. Now the gene testing service has announced it will let customers bar law enforcement from accessing their data. Yeah, right.
Yeah. I was kind of confused with that one because if we look at the next story.
Yeah. Wired. DNA crime solving is still new, yet it may have gone too far.
Yeah, so this was a pretty interesting tale. So I think most people were familiar with the killer Ted Bundy. And mm-hmm. So it says here that they recently used DNA to confirm one of his murder victims. So he murdered many people, but unfortunately they were unable to identify the bodies. So specifically, this talks about how the Kent family was in possession of a patella bone that had been uncovered by investigators in 1989, where Bundy said he had left the teen's remains. At that time, DNA testing was brand new, and the U.S. was still 5 years away from establishing a federal genetic repository for convicted criminals. So then flash forward to 2015, detectives persuaded the Kent family to have the knee bone sent in for testing, and they found that it was a genetic match. And so the Kents finally were able to get that closure. However, if we switch to the story that happened around the same time, but very different outcome. So this was about...
Are you showing on your screen?
Oh, no, I'm not.
Oh. Okay, you're fine. No, continue.
This was about a case, an infant abandonment case in South Dakota from 38 years ago. So they said that a man was driving and found a dead newborn boy with the umbilical cord still attached. So very recently, they were able to identify who the mom would be. So they actually exhumed the body in 2009, and then using the genetic DNA testing and from the tree, they were able to identify the baby's biological mother. And so now she's charged with first-degree murder, second-degree murder, and manslaughter. So now that family secret has kind of...
It's no longer a secret.
Totally upended the family.
Jeez.
So then that's kind of the question of, you know, where's the limit on this? And are we going to become this state where every little bit of DNA is going to be analyzed and then you're going to be linked to who knows what? Or
yeah, and they're already using DNA to map and catch criminals, so it's...
So what they do is by using, like if your relative, for example, has had genetic testing done, they now have enough information where they can kind of pinpoint
who... Anybody.
Yeah, anybody.
Because so, your relatives have put DNA, my relatives, everyone's relatives.
There have been other cases too where they've identified murders just from family members putting up DNA and then they look at these databases and are able to match, so...
Ooh, wow. Well, that's not fun.
Yeah, and the article does say that currently there are no laws. So I actually have it on the screen now. So no laws limit police departments' application of the technique, though the state of Maryland is considering banning it altogether. The public DNA database that allows investigators to find initial genetic matches confined such searches to violent crimes or identifying remains of deceased individuals. Yes, and to answer the chat room's question, this is with, it could be with any of the DNA testing, such as the 23andMe.
All those melamin testing kits. Yeah, so, test my dog. Yeah, exactly. Yeah, that's the service. Yeah, those services are the ones that are selling your DNA to everybody. That's what they're doing.
Don't get tested.
Don't get tested. HealthyTalkShow.com. Don't get tested. DNA tested.
Yeah.
Get tested for STIs, though, every 6 months. Ah, BBC, the human cost of insulin in America. It's actually sparked something. It's no secret that insulin is getting crazy in the United States, but we have a short little documentary from Business Insider. Why insulin is so expensive. Let's play it. It's pretty good.
The average price for one vial of insulin is about $285. Most diabetics need 2 to 4 vials per month. But here's the thing. Insulin prices weren't always this high.
Inexpensive, easily accessible.
A type 1 diabetes diagnosis was a death sentence before this life-saving discovery.
The all-essential insulin.
Without insulin, an essential hormone that regulates blood sugar, your body can't regulate how much glucose enters your cells, and your cells starve. The medical researchers, who patented their invention in 1923, wanted insulin to be affordable for even the poorest sufferers from diabetes. Sure, there have been major improvements.
This new genetically engineered insulin has 2 distinct advantages.
The most recent was about 15 years ago. Insulin's still an old drug. It's shocking that the price has increased so dramatically.
Tripled in the past 15 years?
That's insane.
Tripled? Ay, ay, ay. Would you like to learn how the pricing is set for insulin?
I would. I'm very curious.
The manufacturers make the drug and set the price. This is part of the reason why insulin is so expensive.
The manufacturers make the drug and set the price. That sounds pretty easy to me.
Yeah.
There's no limit to how high the price can be set, and they don't have to disclose how they set it. The manufacturers negotiate with pharmacy benefit managers to be placed on PBM formularies in exchange for rebates. These rebates and negotiations also don't have to be disclosed. Formularies are a list of medicines that the PBM offers. The PBM negotiates on behalf of insurance companies, and the manufacturers give rebates to PBMs in exchange for lower placement on an insurance tier system. The lower placement usually leaves the patient with one option, as it's the most affordable. It's a good place for a brand to be, but it's not always great for the patient. It leaves them with one option, and that option might not even be what their doctor prescribed.
Horrendous.
Yeah.
And now, insulin. Why are prices so high?
Business Insider reached out to the 3 insulin manufacturers, and they each cited the complexity of the supply chain as a reason for their high list prices.
We think there are incentives at every level of the supply chain that facilitate or even encourage the high list price, from the manufacturers to the wholesalers to the PBMs to the health plans.
And at this point, it's safe to call what's happening an insulin crisis. So why isn't the FDA intervening?
Why isn't the FDA intervening? I'll tell you, or this video will.
The FDA can't do anything around price. So the FDA can't say, you have to charge $150 for this and you can't do anything different. That's just not how it works in the U.S. Other countries can have a little bit more sway.
The U.S. does not regulate prices. So that's part of the answer. Insulin's expensive because it can be. There's no limit to how high the price can rise. The FDA regulates and approves drugs and grants patents.
Interesting.
It's just so mind-blowing to me.
Yeah.
And plus there was an article too that we have, the human cost of insulin in America.
Yeah, we had that on a former episode. Do you have that on the screen?
Yeah, I do.
Oh no, this is the one, BBC. Oh,
yeah.
Yep, sorry.
But it talks about how this woman had to give up her dog and all these sort of things, just trying to survive. And this is horrible. And it talks about too what the video mentioned, that people can't even get their preferred insulin brand.
Yeah, it's
and certain people's bodies work better with different brands of insulin, and then they're unable to get it because of these weird tiers.
It's a fix.
Wait, the chat says we look mad.
We're mad about insulin prices.
Yeah, it's insane. People are dying.
Yeah, people are dying because of greed. We're upset. And yeah, it's freaking hot in the studio. Next time we need to run the AC.
Apparently.
Insulin patents. I have another video.
Let's hear it.
In the U.S., a patent excludes others from making an invention for a limited time, usually 20 years. Some critics think that manufacturers of insulin are abusing patents.
For insulin, a careful look is warranted to determine if minor modifications were used to just extend the patent protections and discourage competitors.
What it becomes then is just the patent system has become a strategy, a defensive tool. Is how can I strategize to keep my competitors off? Forget about the patent system being about progressing the sciences and the arts, as the Constitution says. It's become a business strategy.
Yep.
Yeah, and that's not the first time that we've talked about this.
Yeah, the patents.
The drug companies do this too, where they say, oh, this drug can now be used for this new cause, and now that extends our patent.
Extend us.
So yep. None of this helps with the high prices.
And another thing that doesn't help insulin is there are no generics.
But patents aren't the reason why a generic insulin doesn't exist. Unlike chemical medications like Advil and Zestril, there's no generic insulin.
With a chemical drug, you have the same chemicals in it every single time. When it comes to a biologic-based drug like insulin, that's a much more lengthy process. You have to figure out how to make living cells look and feel exactly the same as the original version.
The FDA approval process is lengthy and usually more expensive. In fact, out of all medicines in the US, there are currently only 17 FDA-approved biosimilars. In 2016, a follow-on biologic insulin, which is close to a biosimilar, was approved by the FDA. It was made by one of the three manufacturers, Eli Lilly, which didn't exactly add a new competitor, and it didn't really help the price decrease, which leaves patients on their own to find another option.
That's horrendous.
Yeah.
And I just wanted to pull from the BBC article, how does the UK compare? Well, average cost of out-of-pocket monthly diabetes. Yep, March 2016. Let's see here. Woo!
Jeez.
US is high.
What is Italy doing?
I know. They're doing it right.
I'm going to move there.
Heck yeah. $19 as opposed to $360 according to this chart.
Yeah. I'm thinking sad. That article too, they talked about how some people were traveling to Mexico to get cheaper insulin, or if you're closer to the northern border, then they were traveling to Canada. So it's crazy. You know, yeah. Honestly, with those prices, it might be cheaper to go to Italy, eat the pasta there, fly back with the suitcases full of insulin. Probably.
Yeah.
It's getting outrageous.
It is.
And then what's weird, too, is that drug companies always claim that, oh, no one's paying full price, but when you have people dying.
Yeah. I don't really. Yeah. It's. Yeah. Well, you shouldn't have people dying because they can't afford insulin in our modern society of freaking 5G and Teslas. You know, Tesla spelling sexy with his branding. Think about it. Think about it.
Yeah, I didn't catch that one until
Science
you told me.
Science Daily. Opioid crisis, only a U.S. phenomenon? No? Addiction to prescription opioids has reached a crisis level in the United States. Now the drug is causing concern across the Atlantic. Researchers from Denmark, Norway, and Sweden urge caution after discovering that prescriptions for pain medication, oxycodone, have significantly increased during the last decade. In Denmark, Norway, and Sweden, the pharmaceutical industry is subject to stringent regulation and marketing to doctors is strictly limited. However, with aging populations, reports show these countries have some of the highest rates of chronic non-cancer pain in the world. As a result, the demand for prescription opioids has risen significantly, raising the question of whether the Nordic countries could be headed towards an opioid epidemic like the United States. The researchers established that oxycodone prescriptions are on the increase in all three countries. In Sweden, the number of people with an outpatient prescription for an oxy has more than tripled since 2006. In recent years, Norway liberalized the regulation of opioid prescriptions for chronic non-cancer pain, and the study showed that 1 in 8 Norwegian women and 1 in 11 Norwegian men received prescription opioid outside of a hospital in 2017. In addition, as a general rule, these strong prescriptions should not be used for chronic non-cancer pain, says study author Ashley Elizabeth Moeller from the Norwegian Institute of Public Health. It's easy to get complacent and think that the United States is so different, so their situation is applicable to us. Yet, Oxy is prescribed more and more, according to her.
I found this very interesting. It just further highlights how addictive this substance is, and it continues to be overprescribed. And
yeah,
people start.
And it's not just in the U.S.
Yeah, although, you know, again, it's always hard because you do have chronic pain sufferers, and but you know, the fact that the rates have been rising so much is definitely worrisome, and
yeah.
Well, might lead to yep. fentanyl,
yep,
which I think we'll talk about, right?
Yeah. Well, we will after this story. Business Insider 2016. Something startling is going on with antidepressant use around the world. Brought up this story just because I remember reading about this a few years ago. The Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development, OECD, looked at antidepressant use in 25 countries and found something startling. In every single country the OECD looked at, antidepressant use was on the rise. In Germany, antidepressant use has risen 46% in just 4 years. In Spain and Portugal, it rose about 20% during the same period. Iceland led the pack in overall use, with about 1 in 10 people taking a daily antidepressant. But that figure may underestimate the actual rate of use, since the calculation isn't restricted to just adults. That's not good. Let's take a look at this chart here that they put in. So the United States is up there, although I don't know about that. Iceland is, I don't know. I don't know how accurate this chart is. It's from 2016.
I would say it's okay.
Yeah. So yet another drug that's being prescribed, probably overly prescribed. And
yeah. Well, it's interesting that you mentioned that it might be overly prescribed. I found this study saying that about 5% of people are considered to have depression. It says approximately 5% of the Swedish population, and they said that this is true worldwide, but yet we have 11% of people medicated in America.
Oh, yeah.
And then they're also talking about how in these Nordic countries, even though they allegedly have very low rates of depression, again, self-reported, so hard to totally figure out, but yep, they have very high medication rates comparatively.
And of course they do.
They have, I'll pull a quote, "In a public health perspective, this medical approach may seem questionable, but without further research on depression prevalence and why antidepressants are described, it is difficult to assess potential public health effects. This is of particular concern since antidepressants in the absence of therapeutic alternatives are projected to continue to dominate the antidepressant market to 2018. So this means that people aren't getting counseling. They aren't maybe, you know, thinking about lifestyle changes.
Pop it a pill.
Yeah, just pop a pill.
Yep.
And over there in the Nordic countries, they consider it to be very effective, so they turn to it. And I don't know that that's really...
Well, it is effective. It is effective.
Is it a good long-term solution?
No.
Maybe we need to reevaluate...
Society, you know.
Our sleeping patterns. Yeah,
social media, all kinds of things.
Eating, you know, just...
Everything.
Yeah.
Just put Instead yourself just in a box a and evaluate. Yep.
So.
I know.
Healthy Talk Show.
HealthyTalkShow.com. Ars Technica. After pushing addictive OxyContin, Purdue now pursuing overdose antidote. Purdue still blames a crisis on illicit drugs, but says it won't profit from the antidote. Good. The company announced this week that the U.S. Food and Drug Administration has granted fast-track status to its investigational drug Nalmefene hydrochloride, HCI, an injectable emergency treatment intended to rescue people suspected of having an opioid overdose. Purdue suggests that Nalmefene HCI's effects last longer than the similar emergency opioid antagonist Naloxone. As such, the company hopes Nalmefene HCI will outcompete Naloxone at the reversing overdoses from the most highly potent opioid, namely fentanyl, which is currently driving an alarming number of opioid overdose deaths. The FDA, deaths from the extremely potent fentanyl began spiking nationwide in 2013 and 2017. Synthetic narcotics, mainly fentanyl, were behind roughly 40% of the more than 70,200 overdose deaths in the country. The abrupt rise of fentanyl use and overdoses followed a quadrupling of use and overdoses from prescription opioids, such as OxyContin. As the crisis came to light, opioid prescribing leveled off and began declining in 2012, leading to the rise of illicit fentanyl and heroin use. Purdue announced that it doesn't intend to make money on the new drug. As part of Purdue's commitment to advance meaningful solutions to address the opioid crisis, the company will work to bring forward this option with the commitment not to profit from any future sales of this drug.
Well, we'll see, I guess. Purdue right now is under a lot of scrutiny. I think they're thinking about filing for bankruptcy.
Yep, we reported on that last week.
So we'll keep watching them. We'll see what happens.
Fentanyl, though, that's bad stuff.
Oh, yeah.
It's killing high-end drug-sniffing dogs, the $200,000 ones, the expensive ones. It's in a lot of cocaine, according to a cocaine cowboy I know. So I don't know. Apparently, all cocaine coming in right now is laced with fentanyl. It's hard to get pure cocaine.
That's crazy.
Yeah, I don't know. It's kind of weird.
I don't know either.
I don't know. You tell us if you know. We don't know. Do you know?
Why do people need all these stimulants, though? We're either cracked out on either stimulants or we're hopped up on antidepressants.
Yeah.
We need to step back, you know? Smell the roses, literally.
Smell the roses. Smell the flower.
Breathe it in.
Breathe it in.
Stop snorting the coke.
Light it up. Moving from one company pushing drugs to New York Times, how big tobacco hooked children on sugary drinks. Researchers combing through archives discovered that cigarette makers had applied their marketing wizardry to sweetened beverages and turned generations of children into loyal customers. Ooh. What do these ads featuring Joe Camel, Kool-Aid Man, and the mascot for Hawaiian Punch have in common? All three were created by Big Tobacco in the decades when cigarette makers seeking to diversify their holdings acquired some of America's iconic beverage brands. They used their expertise in artificial flavor, coloring, marketing to heighten the product's appeal to children. Researchers combing through a vast archive of cigarette company documents at the University of California, San Francisco stumbled onto something revealing. Internal correspondence showed how tobacco executives barred from targeting children for cigarette sales focused their marketing prowess on young people to sell sugary beverages in ways that have not been done before. The archive, known as the Truth Tobacco Industry Documents, was created as part of a settlement between major cigarette companies and states that were seeking to recoup smoking-related health care costs. The researchers published their findings on Thursday in the medical publication BMJ. At a time of mounting childhood obesity, with nearly a third of children in the United States overweight or obese and rates of type 2 diabetes soaring among adolescents, the study's authors said it was important to chart how companies created and marketed junk food and sugary drinks to the youngsters. All right. This is a very interesting story. Kind of makes me sad.
Yeah. I was also really shocked.
A little sad.
I didn't realize, too, that in the 1960s, all these sugary drinks were marketed towards adults.
Yeah.
I think it was that article that you have up.
It's the Hawaiian Punch and stuff was definitely, it was an additive for like alcohol or something. So, yep. Before the brand was acquired by R.J. Reynolds in 1963, Hawaiian Punch advertisements display recipes for cocktails and images of adults enjoying Hawaiian Punch. Yep, look at all this. This is great for all you video watchers here, not for the audio listeners.
Somehow in 1962, I think they started the idea of let's market this to children. And so they did product testing, and children liked that nice red Hawaiian Punch that I think we're familiar with today.
Man, that stuff is so bad for you.
Yeah, now, and then they made their ads very, you know, hip, cool. Yep. They also mentioned the Tang commercials, which as a 90s child, I definitely remember Tang.
Yep.
And those orangutans, they were so cool.
Mm-hmm.
And Tang was almost sold as an orange juice alternative.
Ugh! It's nowhere close to juice.
And when they mentioned this too in this article that they advertise, oh yeah, it has all your vitamin C. But they totally ignore the sugar content.
Yeah.
I think it had 15 grams of sugar a serving.
From the BMJ publication, whatever it is. Tobacco industry involvement in children's sugary drinks market. Key messages, tobacco companies acquired soft drinks brands to diversify. Industry documents show they applied marketing strategies aimed at children develop these brands. Child-friendly colors, flavors, and packaging and cartoon characters were used to promote products. Although the brands have been sold to food companies, the marketing technique remains in use despite voluntary agreements not to advertise unhealthy products to children. That's
pretty
disturbing.
Funny.
What about Starbucks? They're everywhere, including college campuses, pushing sugary caffeine to the youngsters. People love the fraps. Every time I'm on campus, I see Starbucks cups. What's going on?
It's true.
We got this
more pushing.
Yeah, and they're so I just see that. Replace the Capri Sun with the Starbucks.
Yeah.
I guess it's
I remember Capri Sun.
Yeah, me too.
For some reason, my mom allowed me to have that
What?
I think she thought it was healthier.
That is not healthy. I Capri know. Sun is not healthy.
But it was something about those pouches.
They're great. And super impractical compared to a juice box, if you think about it. Juice box actually stands up.
I don't know.
Those pouches, I don't know.
90s marketing, man.
I know. What do you think? Ask at healthytalkshow.com. Let us know. We want to hear from you. We love you. CNN. Johnson & Johnson hit with $29.4 million verdict in talcum powder case. A California jury returned a $29.4 million verdict in a trial involving a woman who believes that her mesothelioma is tied to her regular use of Johnson & Johnson's talcum powder. We have two clips about this. One's from RT discussing the story, and then something after that. Let's go. Let's switch go to RT, my friends over at RT Russia Today. Let's see what you got.
A California woman has won a massive lawsuit. Interestingly enough, it's against Johnson & Johnson, one of the oldest healthcare companies in the United States. And this is all about talcum powder, interestingly enough. She says the talcum powder in some form gave her cancer. Is she right? RT correspondent Natasha Sweet has the details.
A California jury rules the largest healthcare company, Johnson & Johnson, must pay $29 million.
I'm sorry, but do I have to point out Natasha working for Russia Today? Think about it. Natasha?
Gosh.
...to a woman who says the company's baby powder contributed to her mesothelioma. An Oakland Superior Court found Johnson & Johnson's baby powder was a substantial contributing factor in Teresa Levitt's cancer. The lawsuit claims many cancers are linked to asbestos in the company's talc-based powders. The suit alleges the healthcare giant hid these risks for decades. But this isn't the only massive lawsuit Johnson & Johnson is facing. There are a whopping 13,000 others pending. And just last year, a jury awarded a Los Angeles woman $25 million who alleged her cancer was caused by the same baby powder. Another 22 women in Missouri were awarded almost $5 million in a similar lawsuit. Now, just hours after the verdict was made Wednesday, Johnson & Johnson saw their stock price drop almost 2%. Now, Johnson & Johnson hasn't immediately responded to the verdict of this latest case, and despite previous court battles, the company has maintained their products are safe to use.
Of course they have. Of course they will. They'll always do that.
Yeah.
We...
I found it pretty interesting that now they're trying to link it to mesothelioma.
Yeah.
Which is more of a lung cancer.
Yeah.
But I do remember never wanting to breathe in that talc powder because of that. But it's also been linked to ovarian cancer, which...
We have a clip of, yeah. I think, talc on trial from 2017, NBC News. We'll see. I'm actually curious which YouTube video is going to get us a call, or what... video is going to get us a flag, because every video we play, we get a flag. Every video episode we upload to YouTube, we get a copyright flag. So I'm wondering which one of these videos we're playing will get us the flag.
Here, in her doctor's waiting room, she was looking through stacks of information.
And then I found this Gilda Radner booklet.
Gilda Radner, the actress.
Right,
who died
of ovarian cancer.
And what did it say?
They had a bunch of different things about what causes ovarian cancer. And down in the bottom on this one page, use of talc in the genital area.
Baby powder.
Right.
Had you ever used it?
Yes.
How often?
Every day, since I was 16 years old.
But comparing the relative risk of getting cancer from cigarettes versus talc looks like this.
Did you
Here's
look
the
at
chart
that chart?
John's...
I'm sorry, I had to pause it because that chart was horrible.
Yeah.
But yes, look at that 10.
Yeah.
To what? And look at the scale on
I
that.
Know.
That's a terrible chart. I'm sorry.
I could have made a better chart. You put some more zeros behind there, make it look a little more impressive.
I'm just saying that was very misleading to the graphs. Look at it.
Look.
And the relative risk of getting cancer from cigarettes versus talc looks like this.
Here's the chart that Johnson & Johnson uses in trial. That's the risk with talc use, baby powder. That's smoking and lung cancer.
Let me ask you something, Kate. Is it as high a cancer-causing substance as smoking? No. But it is significant. And if I'm one of the women in that blue graph, it means everything to me.
Yeah.
Plaintiffs' experts say even a small increased risk could lead to a few thousand ovarian cancer cases each year. If that's true, then why has no U.S. government agency ever listed talc as a possible carcinogen?
I don't know.
Why?
Will this last clip answer that question?
Let's see.
I hope to God it will.
Back in the year 2000, there was a vigorous debate about talc among scientists at the National Toxicology Program, the division of the Department of Health and Human Services responsible for listing carcinogens. We tracked down the scientist who was in charge of that process, chemist Bill Jamieson.
Do you think there is a link between talc and baby powder and ovarian cancer?
Yes, there is.
He's a chemist. We have to trust him. FYI, I'm a big fan of chemists. Love the chemists. Love them all.
Jamieson told us back then, scientists voted during an initial review to list talc as a possible carcinogen. But after a public meeting that included input from Johnson & Johnson and the cosmetic industry, another group of scientists disagreed and the government decided not to list talc. Jamieson thinks his agency made the wrong decision.
In your opinion, was talc not listed because of the science, or was talc not listed because of pressure from the industry?
I would say it's a little of both. It was mostly, again, my opinion, it was mostly because of the pressure, but there was also some doubt that the science was really strong enough.
There it is.
We'll see. It keeps getting tied to more cancer.
I say stay away from talc. Keep it away from your genitals, especially.
And keep it away from your body. Baby.
Yeah, keep it away from your house. Keep it away from, you know, talc is a...
Yeah.
Too many questions.
But you can still buy it on Amazon.
I buy it at Target, probably.
Yeah, it's kind of...
We should put it on our Amazon wish list.
No.
Oh, no, we don't want talc.
I don't want cancer.
We don't want talc.
Not healthy.
All right. Well, moving on. Kaiser Health News. Hidden FDA report details harm caused by scores of medical devices. Uh-oh. The Food and Drug Administration has let medical device companies file reports of injuries and malfunctions outside a widely scrutinized public database, which leaves doctors and medical sleuths in the dark. Let's take a look. The author of this article, Christina Jewett, she actually did a video, which is pretty cool. We're going to cue that up right now. Play the video.
Hi, I'm Christina Jewett. I'm a reporter with Kaiser Health News. And this is a story about hidden reports of harm related to medical devices. I started looking into the issue of medical device safety, and I was talking to a source who told me that there are actually some pathways outside of the standard injury, malfunction, and death reporting that happens with medical devices, and that those outside pathways put some of that information out of the reach of a lot of the doctors or researchers who actually use that information for patient safety reasons. And I thought that was really intriguing, so I decided to dig in.
Interesting. And FYI, I did not clip her mid-sentences or anything. That was not me. That was the video. I don't edit people like that. She edited herself, or whoever edited her did a very poor job. I don't edit sentences like that, so just FYI. I wasn't trying to change what she said or anything.
People like doing that weird editing.
Yeah. So, let's continue. FDA exceptions, or exceptions, I mean.
So basically, what I found out was that there are certain terms that the medical device makers will use when they reference some of these reports that are going outside of the normal channels. And so I searched and searched and searched, and I found about 10 devices that discussed filing summary reports or having a special exemption from the FDA. And so I started asking the FDA questions. And what I found out was that there's a database inside the FDA that's extremely obscure. And basically that's a place where some device makers who have these special exemptions can file serious injury and malfunction reports. And I asked, you know, how many of these, you know, are there each year? And what I've came to find out was that the numbers are pretty huge. In 2014, you're looking at about 430,000.
430,000. 2014.
And that went right up through 2017 to about 480,000.
That's not good. Continuing on.
Yeah.
Last, surgical staplers.
And one of the devices I wound up focusing on that had one of these reporting exemptions is the surgical stapler. And what's interesting about the surgical stapler is that this is a device that usually works just fine, but it actually cuts vessels and it cuts tissue. And so if there is a misfire, if it doesn't work right, very quickly patients can bleed to death. And so what I found out was that in the year 2016, as far as stapler problems go, you see less than 100 reports of injury or malfunction. But after months,
less than 100 reports of injury or malfunction,
of asking questions to the FDA, what I found out was that same year, stapler makers filed 10,000.
10,000?
What?
Just shy of 10,000 reports to this database that's just inside the FDA and is really just not known to the doctors, researchers, and patients who are looking for this kind of information. So there's a number of devices that we took a look at, and I hope you'll take a look at the story and see what you can learn.
Woo! Yeah, this was crazy.
Yep.
And I found this very interesting, too, because it was kind of the doctors themselves that started noticing this, because
yeah.
they just were talking to each other, because they noticed that they started having too many friends, basically. They were experiencing these malfunctions during surgeries.
Yeah.
And of course, you know, this leads to horrible complications, like she mentioned, where patients bleed out.
You can bleed out really quickly
yeah,
with the surgical stapler, apparently.
Yeah. There were many reports in that article about people bleeding out and having brain damage because they lost half their blood. It was just horrible, all because of this misfire. And they went in for simple surgery, and then they ended up, you know, brain damage.
Yeah. Well, I think this will probably get a lot of steam, I hope. And hopefully people will cover this and talk more about this, and we can get some more awareness on what's being hidden.
Yeah, I would like to talk to some doctors out there, too.
If there are any doctors who want to talk to us, I doubt it.
We know some doctors.
We know doctors.
They're just being shy.
Doctors are shy.
Ask at healthytalkshow.com.
Mm-hmm. Don't be shy. We love you. We'll keep you anonymous if you'd like. CNN. Online abortion pill provider ordered to cease delivery by FDA. Also, Daily Mail. FDA cracks down on mail order abortion drug, claiming website sells unapproved versions of the pill. The FDA issued a warning letter to aidaccess.org on Tuesday, but Aid Access mails at-home abortion pills to women who do an online consultation. But the FDA says that the drugs, which come from a pharmacy in India, are not present as labeled or FDA approved. Okay. There are other ways to get abortion pills by mail in the United States for women who can't get to or afford clinic visits, but Aid Access is the most affordable option at $95. It also offers the possibility of financial help, according to its website. Plus, Aid Access is the only company to offer physician oversight. According to a report card issued by grassroots group Plan C, I don't know what that is, which aims to educate women about self-managed abortion, Aid Access was the only one of the 9 suppliers to receive an A. Aid Access has 15 business days from the receipt of the FDA warning letter, which is dated March 8th, to respond. Bam. What do you think?
Well, it's very ironic because a lot of people are always pushing for more access to abortion, especially, you know, for people of lower income. And this seems like a good way since there is some sort of online consultation. Mm-hmm. But again, I'm not a doctor, so,
yeah.
You know, maybe there are more risks, but there's a lot of debate about whether women should be able to have just online consultations. And they argue that the risks of this pill are relatively low.
And so, it's better access because yeah. an issue with birth control in general is access.
Yeah. And especially, you know, in some states they're trying to defund Planned Parenthood, and then that makes it more difficult, or perhaps people can't drive to a clinic. So.
Yeah.
But the FDA, we did talk about the FDA trying to ban other drugs previously, so I don't know. I don't know if the FDA always has our best interests in mind.
We'll see.
We'll see.
We shall see. Science Daily, adolescents are more likely than adults to use fruit and candy-flavored e-cigarettes, study finds.
Surprise.
Surprise. E-cigarettes were initially intended as a tool to help quit smoking, yet vaping has skyrocketed among kids to the point that the U.S. Food and Drug Administration, FDA, and the U.S. Surgeon General both recently declared youth e-cigarette use an epidemic. Adolescent and young adult e-cigarette users are attracted to vaping because of the appealing marketing report tempting e-juice flavors as leading reason for use. They are more interested in experimenting with fruit candy or menthol flavored e-cigarettes than with tobacco flavored e-cigarettes, perceiving sweet flavors as less harmful than tobacco flavors. Well, no shit.
Yeah,
it's disturbing, but that's good that we're finally, at least we're, I don't know. Parents, don't let your kids vape. It's not healthy.
We need to contact the vape researchers.
Yes, we do.
But there have definitely been studies, too, on how, like, ethyl cinnamate is toxic, and that's one of the cinnamon flavorings.
Yeah.
And all these things are not good, and I think we're finding it's just the gateway drug to vaping, which is...
Yeah, it's hooking you to nicotine.
Yeah,
that's what it's all about. Nicotine. Keep you addicted to the nicotine.
Yep.
CNN, 3 or more eggs a week increase your risk of heart disease and early death, study says. New York Times, are eggs bad for your heart health? Maybe. Daily Mail, you must be yolking. Controversial study finds 1 egg a day increases the risk of stroke death by 17%. But critics spot cracks in the findings. Science Daily, higher egg and cholesterol consumption hikes heart disease and early death risk. Bam. What are we doing? What are we saying about this?
Well, you can flip over to my screen. So I was trying to
reported everywhere.
Yeah, so this is the JAMA article. And it seemed kind of clickbaity, the whole thing. Associations of dietary cholesterol or egg consumption with incident cardiovascular disease and mortality. But then if you look at the actual study and kind of read what they kind of say a lot of weird things.
Nonsense.
So one thing, they do admit some shortcomings such that it's a self-reported study, so you depend on people to remember what they ate. They do try to deconvolute for factors such as lifestyle.
Yep.
But then you find this sort of thing.
It's a study of 30,000 people.
Yeah, it was a large study. And it says, sorry, I'm trying to find the start of this. That the associations between dietary cholesterol consumption and incident cardiovascular disease and all-cause mortality were monotonic. Based on Model 2, each additional 300 mg of dietary cholesterol consumed per day was significantly associated with higher risk of incident CVD. But then they said these associations remain significant after adjusting for CVD risk factors. So, such as if you have high BMI, diabetes, blood pressure, also your consumption of animal protein, sodium, cholesterol, or dietary patterns. And then they said that an all-cause mortality were no longer significant after adjusting for consumption of eggs, unprocessed meat, and red meat. So, basically, that the eggs weren't correlated. And then they kind of say this again. So the association between dietary cholesterol consumption and all-cause mortality was stronger in women. But dietary cholesterol consumption was significantly associated with stroke. But this association was no longer significant after adjusting for egg consumption alone. So again, it's not just eggs. It seems to be what else you're eating, if you're eating the saturated fats,
yep,
like more red meats, more fatty meats. Then they make this weird line later. I don't know if I could find it in the text, but I do have the quote pulled
out.
Just
say the quote. It's fine.
So it said, for example, egg consumption was commonly, the association between egg consumption and stroke was no longer significant after adjusting for dietary cholesterol consumption. After they said that egg consumption was significantly associated with stroke. So make up your mind.
Yeah. So yeah. The stories. Critics say the findings are flawed because participants were only asked once. The participants had to remember how many days in a year they had eaten eggs. Once the researchers, like you said, adjusted for a total cholesterol intake, the egg connection disappeared. Experts say watch your cholesterol by quitting cigarettes and doing more exercise, but the egg question has not been answered.
Yeah. They also had this weird line in there that said egg consumption was commonly correlated with unhealthy behavior, such as low physical activity.
What?
I mean, I would say...
And all those people that drink raw eggs and shakes and stuff, you know, all the muscle people.
Well, it also goes back to muscle what beach. Are you eating with your eggs? Are you eating eggs and sausage? And,
yeah.
You know?
We just eat straight up eggs.
Yeah, I think.
We cook them, of course.
If you have eggs, kind of like how we prepare them, we actually do use nonstick, even though we try not to use nonstick, but we'll go into that another day. But minimal oil, keep it healthy. For the record, so eggs generally have 186 milligrams of cholesterol. But there are also some studies, they kind of said that, oh, like the way all those headlines were worded were really misleading.
And everyone picked up the story.
Yeah, so it was really weird.
Everybody picks up these stories all the time. They don't look into anything. They just read them.
Yeah, so it was...
They just look at the headlines and read the summary. And, oh, yeah, good. Yep, eggs. Eggs are going to kill you.
Yeah, but... As with most things, it's all the factors, how much you exercise, what else you eat, etc. Smoking, of course, is also bad.
Yep. Cigarettes, especially. Cigarettes are bad to smoke. Speaking of smoking, Daily Mail. Marijuana really does give women better orgasms. Study found that marijuana use prior to sex does improve overall experience. Women who smoked reported increased sex drive, more orgasm satisfaction. Differences translate to 2.13 higher odds of satisfactory orgasms for pot users. It's unclear why that is, but it may be linked to reduced stress, heightened senses.
Hmm.
And they actually referenced a study, which I think you looked into more than I did.
The study was pretty decent.
Yeah, it's not a bad study.
I mean, it was small. Oh, just leave it there. So it was 373 participants and 34% of them reported having used marijuana. And they... found that they had 2.1 times higher odds of reporting satisfactory orgasms.
That's good. Yeah. Marijuana appears to improve satisfaction with orgasm. The conclusion says, a better understanding of the role of the endocannabinoid system in women is important because
there's a paucity of literature.
Literature, yep. I was covering that word. And it could help to lead to the development of treatments for female sexual dysfunction.
Yeah, you know, sign me up for that study.
Yeah, how can I get in on that study? I would love to help with that study.
Well, you've heard some anecdotes.
Yeah, I've conducted research in this, actually.
And what is your small...
Well, anything that can naturally help with orgasms is appreciated. Let's be real. If marijuana is legal where you're at, and you haven't tried mixing marijuana and sex, I highly recommend it. Just give you a tip, Healthy Talk Show. Give me another tip.
Wait, you said that you have friends, right?
Yes, I have friends that have tried it, and they reported to me that it is easier to have an orgasm, and the orgasm is usually much stronger if they're under the influence of cannabis.
So if anyone...
And I've witnessed this firsthand in a scientific setting, of course.
If anyone wants to do further research with Robert...
Yeah.
Ask
at healthytalkshow.com, please. We need more research on this matter. Yes. This is a very important topic. Very passionate about this.
Yeah, Robert's an aspiring sexologist. So
yeah, that's what...
Your first paper could be about that.
Oh, shoot. That'd be great. And I'm going to skip this story. Daily Mail. Woman 44 is rushed to hospital after passing out because she had a stroke while nearing orgasm when her partner was performing oral sex. The woman from West London spent 2 weeks in hospital recovering. Her partner said her body went stiff when she passed out during oral sex. She only suffered a moderate headache afterwards, but scans revealed a bleed. And this was actually documented here at BMJ Case Reports. I don't know how to say that word.
Subarachnoid hemorrhage.
Hemorrhage, yeah. Which is a life-threatening type of stroke caused by bleeding into the space surrounding the brain. But yeah, this was officially documented and interesting.
That must have been some really good oral.
That must have been some really good oral. That's maybe they were conducting a study.
Yeah.
they were...
Hopefully they use their dental dam. Or they were a monogamous couple.
Hopefully they used their dental dam or they've been tested and they were a long-term couple and they know each other, they trust each other, they're not spreading STIs. Yeah. It's very good.
Dang, props to him, I think.
Oof, props to him. What?
I'm just saying, it must have been good.
Well, maybe. That's good. We're done talking about health stuff, I think.
We forgot to say Happy St. Patty's Day.
No, it's Happy St. Patrick's Day. Now we're going to talk about St. Patrick's Day.
Yeah, you're wearing the green. Yeah. I got my...
We're wearing green. Happy St. Patrick's
Kiss
Day, everybody.
Me, I'm Irish.
We're going to do a little... We got some videos about St. Patrick's Day and the history of St. Patrick's Day if you guys want to... Oh, I'm... Yeah. I'm... Let's watch these videos about St. Patrick's Day.
St. Patrick's Day is one of the most globally celebrated saints' days. Across the world, there are green festivities.
Name another saint that's celebrated. Can't.
So saint.
Saint.
Saint
on
Nick.
Saint Nick. There
as
you
far
go.
And wide as Japan.
There you go.
Argentina and
I don't
Russia.
Think there is one.
St. Patrick's Day is widely celebrated for a number of reasons. The most significant being Irish mass migration. There are approximately 70 million people on Earth with Irish blood.
It's quite a bit.
Emigration has been part of Irish history since at least the Middle Ages. But it peaked during the Irish famine of the 1840s. A quarter of the population left, seeking new lives, mostly in America, the United Kingdom, Canada, and Australia.
Cool. Now, let's learn about how it started in America and Guinness.
Surprisingly, St. Patrick's Day, as we've come to know it, was invented in America.
Surprise.
In 1762, Irish soldiers marched through New York City, beginning the traditional St. Patrick's Day parade.
Of course.
Today, parades are held in many different countries, with revelers downing 13 million pints of Guinness.
Jeez.
Say 30 or 13?
13 million.
I thought she said 30, but it shows 13.
Yeah.
That's a lot.
But there's another secret to the success of St. Patrick's Day. Irish pubs.
I didn't know this about Irish pubs, and how Guinness is a big... Yeah, I didn't know they're...
I didn't realize
they're intertwined.
Either.
You'll check this. Check this.
Estimated there are 8,500 Irish pubs around the world, from Nepal to Dubai, and even Mongolia. The deluge of drinking establishments is thanks, in part, to Guinness, who in the 1990s began exporting its concept of the Irish pub around the world.
Very
interesting. Providing designs and advice to aspiring publicans.
Yep.
And, if they wanted it, even shipping them a pre-built bar. In the past 25 years, Guinness has helped open pubs in more than 150 countries.
I had no idea.
Yeah. I
just thought they were a beer, and we were talking about, what's the Irish beer? And you said Guinness. It apparently is the Irish beer.
That's
it's the
crazy.
King of Irish beers.
I had no idea it was that important.
Oh,
or responsible.
Yeah. For St. Patrick's
the
Day
Irish
celebration.
The Irish government is trying to capitalize on the country's growing fame. This year, its ministers will travel to over 50 different nations and cities to promote their country. And it's working. Brand Ireland is now one of the fastest growing nation brands in the world.
What?
Sláinte.
Wow. Well.
That's crazy.
Yep. According to Wikipedia, the St. Patrick's Day, the intro. I just like this part. However, there's been criticism of St. Patrick's Day celebrations for having become too commercialized and for fostering negative stereotypes of the Irish people.
It's pretty funny.
Pretty funny. All right. 10 things you didn't know about St. Patrick's Day. Time.com. I thought this one was interesting. You have the shamrock. You have whatever. Just click on the link. St. Patrick's blue. St. Patrick's color was blue, not green, say historians.
So how do we get to green?
If I could, here you go. Can you read that?
Yep.
I have no idea.
The hue St. Patrick's blue, a lighter shade, can still be seen on ancient Irish flags.
Well, there you go. But it was not green. How do we get things wrong? How do we always do things
incorrectly? But the use of green on St. Patrick's Day began during 1798 Irish Rebellion, when the clover became a symbol of nationalism and the wearing of the green on lapels became regular practice.
I go like back to blue.
Green blue's, spread to... The, I like green.
Blue's a better color. Blue's a better color. Time. Guinness.
It's good.
Things you didn't know about it.
So I didn't know a lot of these things. I thought it was black.
You really thought it was black?
Yeah.
It's not. In fact, Guinness is a stout beer is neither black nor dark brown. If you look closely in the right light, you can see it's really very dark red.
I had no idea.
Yep. I thought it was high in calories.
Yeah, me too.
It's not. 125 calories per 12-ounce serving.
That's not too
just
bad.
15 more than the same size serving as Bud Light. Which one would you rather have, Guinness or Bud Light?
Yeah, I'd much rather have Guinness.
Bud Light tastes...
Bud Light's horrible.
Awful. Ugh.
Not that I can drink.
Myth, Guinness is good for you? What? I've never heard of that myth.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, that's Guinness. Don't, you know, we were talking about drinking green beer. We wanted to say, oh, don't drink green beer.
Yeah.
Smoke the green flower instead. I still support that. Lower calorie. Still 125 calories per 12 ounces. Still calories. When you smoke, you don't have any calories.
That's true.
If it's legal in the area that you live.
And then there's some people like me.
Yeah. High in gluten. Yeah. Beer is very high in gluten.
I can't have beer. I can't have the gluten.
Yep.
You know, it's, I just had one throwaway thing that I forgot about.
Do you want me to go to your camera?
Yeah, or go to my screen.
Yeah, yeah.
I forgot Krispy Kreme does the green donuts.
What? Thing. I didn't know that. Yeah. That's a thing?
Yeah.
Oh, wow.
And the... And
does it make you poop black like the Whoppers?
You know, someone else will have to report back to us on that. Yeah, I
think it probably will, won't it? Because wasn't that the food coloring in those Whoppers that made you... No, that did... The black Whoppers made you poop green. That's what it was.
I don't remember.
I don't remember. Too much poop. Yeah. I don't eat any of that stuff. I just hear about it because people eat crazy things.
Yeah. Well, somebody brought green donuts to share to my work on Friday.
What?
So that's how I saw it.
You bring me one? You didn't bring me a donut. Oh, Pa.
I'm sorry.
No, it's okay. I don't need that crap.
Next time.
HealthyTalkShow.com/support. Go there. You can buy us stuff on Amazon. It's pretty cool. There's a trackball for me. I need a trackball. There's some beef jerky, some games. You buy us stuff. Healthy. You can give us money on PayPal.
Oh, we did have a new Prime subscription.
Oh,
today.
Yeah. Thank you, YOLO Schwaglord. Twitch.tv/HealthyTalkShow. You can Twitch Prime. Yeah. It does not automatically renew. If you have Amazon Prime, you can give us free money.
Yes, you just have to keep doing it.
Go to healthytalkshow.com/support and click the Twitch Prime link. It'll tell you how to do it. You can link your Amazon Prime subscription to your Twitch and give us free money every month. It's $2.50 a month every time.
Easy.
Easy, free for you, money for us.
Yes, we appreciate it.
We appreciate it. Thanks for tuning in. If you found value and useful information in this show, please support the show by emailing us, ask@healthytalkshow.com. Leaving us a voicemail, 509-878-3229, or supporting us financially at healthytalkshow.com/support. We'd love to hear from you. Thanks again. Love and light. Good night.
Love and light.